Greetings, all you 99 percenters. This is your host, Dr. Jack Rasmus. This is Alternative Visions. Okay, we're going to continue our saga of the banking crisis here, and we want to focus on the Federal Reserve. You know, the Fed and Chair Powell here this past week just raised interest rates again, their benchmark policy rate, another 0.25%, right? If you watched what the business media discussion was and what Powell said in his press conference, you will get the impression that the Fed is between a rock and a hard place. It doesn't really know what the hell to do. It's got a big contradiction that it's facing, and that is if it raises interest rates further, it's going to exacerbate the banking crisis. And I'll explain how that connection occurs here shortly. If it doesn't raise rates further, then it leaves its strategy to bring down inflation by squashing demand partly unresolved. And that means inflation won't get down below 4%. You know, it's gotten down from about 8.5 to about 6 here in CPI, with the most rapid run-up in history of Fed interest rates over the last year. 5 percentage points, just about, you know, when this thing started. This Fed rate hike started a little over a year ago. Rates were like 0.25%, and they quickly rose to 5% here right now. So that's almost like a 5% rush up. And you can't have that kind of a rapid acceleration of rates without causing financial stress. And that's actually what happened. I've been saying for all since this rate increase began that they can't raise rates more than 5.5% without precipitating that. Well, you know, they precipitated it at 4.75 even before I predicted. I've been saying that also even further back since 2017 in the publication of my book, Central Bankers at the End of Their Ropes, Monetary Policy in the Coming Depression, where I predicted the same. Given the deep financialization of the U.S. and global economy, they cannot raise rates the way they used to try to dampen inflation. And I said then that they probably couldn't raise rates more than 5%. So I've been saying this for some time because of the financialization. All the free money that the Fed has been pumping into the economy, especially since 2008 in the crisis, is now coming home to roost. And I'll explain that connection there between free money that results in zero rates, real interest rates adjusted for inflation are below zero. They've been negative for quite some time. When you look at the Federal Reserve and its role in the regional banking crisis, which, by the way, is still continuing. You know, don't write this. These things don't pop off, in 1 week and whatever. They grow slowly, intensify. And that's where we are, you know, in the U.S., the regional banks that were tied to the tech sector and to some extent the crypto sector have imploded. The Silicon Valley Bank, overexposed to the tech sector, which I talked about in the show last week, and which I've written about in my Banking Crisis 2023 article. Go check it out. It's an extended 4,000-word piece on my blog, which is at jackrasmus.com. That in the show last week and this show this week, where I'm focusing on the Fed's role in all this, together kind of give you my perspective on what's going on. We had the crash of the Silicon Valley Bank and Signature Bank and another one I forgot offhand here, the initial impact. First Republic Bank almost crashed, the big banks led by Jamie Dimon, CEO of J.P. Morgan, threw $30 billion into the black hole there at First Republic. Its stock price continued to fall. So now they're talking about maybe converting that promise of loans to First Republic into an actual cash injection or an equity injection, right? They're struggling with First Republic. Its stock price is still falling. I think yesterday it fell 15% more. The stock price used to be well over 100. I think it's like $12 now. They're struggling. They're throwing money at that. But there's another one. The bank price is falling called PacWest Bank Corp. Watch that one. And watch the, there's an index for regional banks in the U.S. I think it's called KBW Index, whatever. Watch that, because falling stock price means it's in trouble. And when stock prices are falling, guess what happens to investors? They take their money out. And when they take their money out, depositors take their money out as well. And then the bank's balance sheet is deep in the red, and the bank has to get money somewhere or it accelerates all the withdrawals. They either get money from the government or they get money from a consortium of other private bankers trying to bail it out or investors. They got to do something to fill that black hole on their balance sheet. Because of withdrawals and collapsing asset prices, the value of their assets collapse, and that puts them in the red, too. Withdrawals mean they don't have the cash. That means assets are gone. That puts them in the red. There's a whole series of events that occur when a bank, descends into instability here. And stock prices are an example of that. Withdrawals are another example of that. Rising insurance contracts called credit default swaps to insure against its failure, the rising price of that. Investors, if they want to keep their money, they got to buy CDSs to guarantee if the bank does fail that they'll get paid by whoever insured them. All those are indicators of a bank's imminent instability and maybe crash here. Ultimately, the Fed has to put some money, the government has to put some money in the bank. And that leads to an interesting statistic that just appeared here. The Fed and other government agencies in just the last 7 to 10 days have thrown $400 billion at this. Yeah, $400 billion. In what form? Well, one conduit is what's called the Federal Reserve's discount window. This is banks in trouble can go to the Fed and borrow short term at the pretty low rates, money from the Fed to fill their black hole, right? And stem the withdrawals and the depositors, investors' withdrawals. Okay, so the discount window, since this crisis in SVB, Silicon Valley Bank, erupted, has been withdrawn $164 billion from the discount window. Okay, that's money Fed pumps into the economy. FDIC, that insures depositors, right, has thrown $180 billion into it. And then there's this other conduit called the repo market, in which the Fed buys and sells bonds. And the Fed has thrown $60 billion into the repo market. So that's $400 billion already of the Fed, and which just about wipes out what the Fed has been trying to do over the past year with regard to withdrawing prior money it threw into the economy during COVID. How much did it throw into the economy? $5 trillion. Yeah, when COVID hit, the Fed dropped interest rates to zero again, and QE, and everything just flooded the banks and investors with free money, massive amount, $5 trillion in 2 years, right, of debt. That's Fed debt, Federal Reserve debt, $5 trillion to bail out the banks. And guess what? the banks didn't need bailing out under COVID. They were doing just fine. This was the first time in our history that the central bank, the Fed, pre-bailed out the banks. You know, in 2008, they had to actually bail them out. That cost $4 trillion, $4.5 trillion, right? And the Fed never recalled that excess money that threw into the economy for the next 10 years, didn't recall it, just left it there. And what did investors and corporations do with all that free money that drove rates to zero? What did they do with it? They invested it in financial asset markets or sent it abroad. That's why it didn't get into the real economy in the U.S., and that's why we had such a low growth rate. All that free money in 21st century financialized capitalism goes into financial assets, most of it, because it's more profitable than investing in real things that hire real people that build stuff, right? Well, that's not as profitable as throwing it into the stock markets when you've got a bubble and the stock price goes up and you have an immediate capital gain, right? Or if the stock is in trouble, you can immediately sell it and get your money out of it. Unlike if you build a factory, well, it's kind of hard to sell a factory, right? Or a refinery, oil refinery or whatever. So capitalists are investing more and more in financial assets, and the Fed is feeding the beast. All the free money out there is feeding the beast, especially since 2008. This has actually been going on since the mid-80s, since about 86, 87, and it's caused bubbles time and time again, financial bubbles, right? We had the stock market bubble. We had the residential regional housing bubble, regional bank bubble in the 80s. Right in the 90s, we had currency bubbles, right, in Asia and so forth. And, of course, we had the housing bubble and a tech bubble, smaller tech bubble here around the turn of the century. And then we had the big one, you know, the housing bubble and credit derivative bubble on top of it, right? And, you know, before 2008 crash, the Fed's balance sheet, its debt level, was like $800 billion. You know? After 2008-09, $4.5 trillion. And as I said, they never were able to get that money back out of the economy and sloshing around, you know, causing excess investment in financial asset markets, not getting into the real economy. Under Obama, the real economy grew about two-thirds of normal historic recovery from recession, never really took off. And then Trump comes, and the Fed tried to raise interest rates, and Trump slapped them down. They backed off, and they went back in 2019, they went back to free money again. Right? And then COVID hit, and on top of the $4.5 trillion, they threw $5 trillion more free money, right? The Fed. Sloshing around out there, investors, you know, are in nirvana here with all the free money they borrow. And, you know, here's an example. Apple was sitting on a $252 billion hoard of cash, and they were still borrowing money to give to their shareholders, tens of billions of dollars. They were borrowing it. Why? Because interest rates were so low. The Fed made it so low, it was, you know, feasible for Apple and all these tech companies to borrow money, issue corporate bonds, which is borrowing money, right, from investors, give it to the shareholders and themselves, because the tech guys, you know, own most of this tech stock, give it to themselves and sit on the hoard. And, you know, that was extreme in the case of Apple, but it was true all over tech. And it fueled the big tech boom that continued until last year. The tech bubble busted last year, and that's what brought down these regional banks that were focused on the tech sector and, to some extent, crypto. You know, some of them really got wild and focused on crypto. Signature Bank that collapsed collapsed largely because of crypto. Silicon Valley Bank collapsed largely because of tech. First Republic is exposed to both tech and crypto. And I don't know where PacWest Bancorp is in terms of that. But it's these busting bubbles. You know, the bubble busted in housing, precipitating the financial crisis back in 2007-08. But the bubble here that's busting is the tech bubble. And it's pulling down the regional banks exposed to the tech sector. That's what's going on. And by the way, the tech bubble is still deflating here. More and more layoffs are being announced and occurred. You know, that's not finished yet. That's going to continue. So it's a history of bubbles here, whether it's housing or tech or crypto. Or the next one I predict is going to be the commercial property market here in about a year. Okay. It's a history of bubbles, but what causes the bubbles? The bubbles is excess liquidity, excess money capital provided, pumped into the economy by the Federal Reserve. So the Fed is the long-run fundamental cause of this, the Fed policies, fundamentally. You see, when you talk about causes, you've got to distinguish between types of causes. There's fundamental causes, there's enabling causes, and there's precipitating causes. I talk about that in my article that I referenced earlier here on my blog. Well, the Fed is the fundamental cause. You wouldn't have these bubbles and all this overinvestment in financial assets of various kinds if the Fed hadn't pumped all this free money into the economy. So the Fed is the ultimate fundamental cause of this. Capitalist monetary policy is the ultimate cause of this. Now, what is the enabling cause? In other words, that helps exacerbate and accelerate the crisis. Well, it's deregulation is one of the enabling causes. After the crash of 2008-10, they passed in 2010 this thing called the Dodd-Frank Act, that was supposed to stabilize the big banks or banks in general. Conveniently, they didn't implement the 2010 Dodd-Frank Act for 5 years. They let the lobbyists for the banks, pick it apart. So by the time it actually got effective, I think 2014-15, it was already quite weak, right? Every year, the Fed conducts these phony stress tests to the big banks, right? It tells them exactly what they got to do to pass it before. month, 2 months before, it tells them, okay, these are the numbers you got to hit in order to pass the stress test. That's like telling kids the answers to the test before they actually take it, right? So the stress test is really, a phony affair. But more important, they exempted in 2017 or 18 under Trump, they exempted the small regional banks, the regional banks that are now going bust. They exempted them from that. They took them out of it. So there was no regulation really going on, a la Dodd-Frank, of the regional banks. Well, that enabled the crisis, of course, because the federal government couldn't see what was going on at Silicon Valley Bank. Well, they have other ways of seeing, and there's some evidence that they kind of did see, but they didn't do shit. They let Silicon Valley Bank go. Why? These tech banks in the tech sector is a big political financial campaign contributor, Democrat Party. They didn't want to step on them, right? I think they kind of knew what was going on. But the point is, what was going on was exacerbated by the exemption from regulations under Dodd-Frank. So that enabled the whole thing. And, of course, other enabling causes have to do with Silicon Valley Bank management that mismanaged everything, right? They did not hedge, as they say, against the risky investments they were doing. They did not hedge against it, serious fiduciary practice would have insisted. They invested long-term. And the problem with long-term investments is when you got to raise cash, you can't. You got to sell the long-term investment, and then it's kind of hard to sell long-term. So they got caught with the classic investing long and not much cash on hand to when their assets declined in value, when their bonds, the Treasury and corporate bonds started falling in price as the Fed raised interest rates. We'll come back to that. When that happened, there were the Silicon Valley Bank management was in deep doo-doo, right? Where are they going to get the money to fill that black hole? If they don't fill the black hole, investors and depositors leave because it looks like the bank is shaky, right? So they got to say, oh, no, we got lots of money capital on hand. Don't worry about it. Once that worry worm gets into the heads of investors and depositors, they're not going to believe what the hell you say. They're going to leave, right? They're going to withdraw their deposits and investment and so forth. And what happened to Silicon Valley Bank was the VCs, venture capitalists, who funded a lot of the deposits that went into small startups that went into Silicon Valley Bank, right? The VCs started calling around their companies that had invested and said, oh, move your money, move your money. So that was enabling. Right? Mismanagement and VCs pulling the plug on Silicon Valley Bank. And that's a process going on in other banks as well. They started leaving in droves, and that left Silicon Valley Bank holding the bag, right? So it was mismanagement at Silicon Valley Bank and the VCs that exacerbated and also contributed, right? Enabling cause contributed to the crisis there and still is contributing, right? Now, the precipitating cause is the Fed raising interest rates, because it raised interest rates at this historic rapid pace last year. And the way bonds work is that when the rates go up, the price of the bond goes down, right? And Silicon Valley Bank had loaded up on a lot of long-term treasuries that the Fed pushed on them during COVID. And they bought. Well, why did they buy so many treasuries? Right? Because treasuries are a nice form of reserves. If the bank increases its reserves on hand, it can lend out more. Right? The banks create the money supply by lending, but they can only do it based on the value of the reserves that they hold, reserves requirement, as it's called, that can't be lended out because it's a treasury bonds and bills and notes, and you can't lend those out. But you use them as a collateral for actually issuing IOUs to borrowers and lending it out. Okay, so the Fed precipitated bond price collapse by raising rates. Not just treasuries. If they were holding corporate bonds, whatever, that would collapse too. Well, when the price collapses, deflation occurs. Well, you got a big hole on your balance sheet. You got to raise money capital to offset the hole. People will run away, withdraw, and they desperately tried Silicon Valley Bank to sell bonds, sell some of these treasuries, but they couldn't because the price was falling. Who wants to try to catch a falling knife? That's the bond price collapse that was going on. And that flopped. They lost $2 billion. So then they desperately tried to get Goldman Sachs, help them issue some new stock, but that wasn't working out. And then, of course, they got taken over quickly. And as I've written, the speed of what's going on in terms of bank runs and withdrawals here is new. It looks like the Feds are moving quick, but the investors and depositors are moving quicker, right? And why is that? Well, ironically, that's because of technology. All it takes to withdraw your money is pick up your iPhone and do a wire transfer. And that works immediately until, of course, the bank shuts down the servers. But that rapid withdrawal, means the bank runs occur very quickly now. It's not like in the old days, where in the 30s where they go back and banks were failing and people just rushed down to the door in the entry to the bank and pound on the door. We want our money. We want our money. And the bank said, we don't got it. We don't got it. And that's the end of the bank. It's not like that anymore. It's all done electronically, iPhones, right? And the Fed can't, and the regulators can't move fast enough to stop it. And once that's cancer fear psychology penetrates in the investors and depositors, investors first because they're watching this stuff real quick, then it's hard to turn that around. And that's what the Fed's trying to do. It's trying to say, okay, you know, we're throwing money into the black hole here. Even banks, you know, that aren't in trouble, just to assure everybody that your bank is okay. Don't withdraw, right? That's what this is all about. But, you know, the bank CEOs can say, oh, you know, we got plenty of liquidity and cash on hand. And the government says, you know, we will back depositors. But, you know, investors and depositors aren't dummies. You know, are they going to believe the bullshit being thrown at them, you know, by politicians and so forth? Well, most of them won't. They can say, well, I'm going to be careful just in case. You know, maybe it's true. Maybe the bank does have money. Maybe the Fed is throwing in money. But just to be sure, you know, I'm going to move my money to a safe place. And that's what's happened in the regional banking industry. The money is flowing to the big banks. And that's why J.P. Morgan and his bank, big bank friends can turn around and say, oh, we're going to give you $30 billion of it back here. Well, we're not going to give it to you. We're going to invest in so we can take you over later, right? So that's why they can, because a lot of depositors' money flew out of these regional banks into the big banks, you know, Chase, Wells, Citi, B of A, et cetera, and or to the credit unions. You know, local, they flew into the credit unions, big deposit surge into credit unions and big banks out of the regional banks. And, you know, the consequence of this is going to be bank lending is going to dry up, no doubt. Which brings us back to Powell in the Fed. Because what Powell said in his press conference after the Fed this past week raised rates by 0.25%, what he said was, we may not have to raise rates any higher here. We're going to watch it. Because the, without saying exactly, the effect of the banking crisis is that lending credit is going to dry up anyway now. And as he said, this was like raising interest rates. And it's true. Yeah, it's like raising, because the idea of raising interest rates is to stop the flow of credit into the economy. So the banking crisis is going to raise the next rates for the Fed. The Fed won't have to. This is kind of what he's saying, you know, why we only did 0.25%. And really, I think it's all done. There isn't going to be, especially if the banking crisis continues to reverberate here. You're not going to see another Fed hike in May. You know, 5% is all they're going to do. And he's talking about, well, the interest rate by the end of the year will average 5.1%. Well, that tells me there's no more interest rate hike's coming, right? If we're at 5% now, and he said the average is going to be 5.1% by the end of the year, voila, that's no more interest rate hikes, you know? And the markets, the investors, the market, they call them the markets, you know, so that you don't know that these are rich, rich capitalists who are doing this investing, right? You don't want to make them human beings. You call them the markets, right? So the markets are now betting that rates are going to start coming down because the recession is going to get worse because bank lending and credit crunch, you know, bank lending is going south and credit crunch is going up, even if the Fed doesn't raise interest rates anymore. Right? So deeper recession coming. You know, talking about the real economy, the consumer hasn't really been spending. Increasing spending. No. They throw these statistics at you from the government and they say, oh, you know, retail sales went up 6%. Well, that's not adjusting for inflation. Inflation went up 6%, and that means real retail sales are flat. And, you know, retail sales is the biggest part of consumer spending. And that's 2/3 of the economy, GDP. So that's flat. And now we're going to have business investment slowing down because bank lending is going to slow down. So those two big engines of the real economy are sputtering and coming to a halt. On top of that, you know, you've got export production, export sales, and imports, and that's another factor there. That's in trouble, too. The only thing you've got is government spending, and most of that now is not going into the pockets of individuals because all the COVID relief has been pulled and finished. You know, that's going into, guess who? Businesses to invest. Biden passed three bills last year, right? The infrastructure bill, right? Science and R&D Act, semiconductor bill, and the so-called misnamed Inflation Reduction Act. Those are all three in government investment bills, stretched up over 5 to 10 years, by the way, over $1 trillion, right? But it goes into businesses. It's a stimulus for businesses to invest, whether it's in tech or whether it's in, you know, traditional infrastructure, or whether it's in alternative energy and, you know, traditional energy. That's what those three acts are about. So that's the only really engine going on for the real economy, right? And the rest is stalling. And so the banking crash is going to exacerbate the real economy slowdown here, very clear. And the Fed is right in the sense that they may not have to raise rates. They're not going to because it exacerbates banking crisis, but they may not have to because the banking crisis is going to do the job for them. And that's kind of what he said, what Powell said. Right? First thing he did when he came out in this press conference, you know, first immediate thing he did, he talked about the banking crisis. And he said, oh, you know, the banking crisis is fine, and, you know, there's plenty of liquidity, and we're watching this, and we're doing this, you know. So, yeah, he's throwing $400 billion at it in 1 week here. Yeah, they're watching it. And then there's this side story about the depositors' insurance, right? Right now, depositors in the banking system are insured up to $250,000. In other words, the government, under the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, FDIC, will guarantee you $250,000 against any losses if a bank fails, right? FDIC. At Silicon Valley Bank, over 90% of the investors and depositors had more than $250,000. That's why they had to bail in the depositors out, right? That's why a lot of the FDIC, $180 billion, is not all going to SVB. It's going to a number of other banks as well as a precaution. Okay, so, you know, the FDIC is $250,000, and the crash here of these regional banks, the talk is, we got to increase that, you know, because with Silicon Valley Bank, 90% had more than $250,000. So it's time to increase that $250,000 limit by the FDIC. That started a flurry of discussion, you know, how much, you know, and the regional banking industry trading arm said, you should guarantee 100% of all the depositors for 2 years, right? No matter what, everyone gets their money back, right? Well, you know, that's like hundreds of billions of dollars risk, maybe trillions, I don't know, for every penny of every deposit at every regional bank. And even if they say so, they'll do that. They can't. There's not enough money, right? They'd have to throw, I don't know, the Fed would have to pump hundreds of billions of dollars more into the economy. They're not going to do that. But they hope by saying so. That kind of stops it. Well, you know, there are bills in Congress to raise it, probably 400,000, 500,000, I don't know. That's working its way through Congress. We'll see what happens there. And then we have the sideshow with Janet Yellen, Treasury Secretary. She's in the Senate Banking Committee and giving testimony, and she lets it flip a faux pas here by saying, we're not going to bail out the investors, you know, and shareholders. We're really not going to have a blanket bailout of all the depositors either, right? Whoa, that kind of exacerbated things. That, you know, that was interpreted, in the economy and in the business media that, oh, no more money is coming. You know, the media corrupted and distorted what she said. But she put her foot in her mouth, right? And I tweeted that she's going to have to now backtrack and cover all that up, right? Which is what she's doing, right? She's saying now, next day, without saying she misspoke, she did. And she's saying, two things. One, you know, the decision is not really finally made yet, and it's a decision by Congress, not me, Treasury Secretary, to make. Also FDIC. In other words, the other part of bureaucracy said, hey, wait a minute, Janet, you know, you're stepping on our turf here, you know, back off. And she did, right, today. And, she's sort of smoothing it all over, saying, well, you know, maybe we'll give more money, you know, if more banks fail. They got to say whatever they need to say if this contagion, the psychology of this contagion, continues to accelerate throughout the banking system, the regional banks. Big banks are in trouble. Regional banks. Right? By the way, you know, regional banks have been at the heart of crashes and depressions throughout the history of the economy in the U.S. You know, we had three great depressions in the 19th century. Three great depressions. 1837-42. 1873-78, 1892-98, and in each one of those, the regional banks, which were totally unregulated, crashed. Every one of them crashed because bubbles had been created. I won't go into various bubbles. If you want my view on that, I had a book published in 2020, another one called Alexander Hamilton and the Origins of the Fed. Right, or when I looked at 19th century crashes and the key crash in 1907, financial crash that led to the creation of the Federal Reserve in 1913, all of those. Anyway, you know, the regional center, but small and medium banks have always been exposed and brought down the system because they've been largely deregulated and they engage in over. Extended risky investments, be it in real estate or whatever, canals and railroads and so forth, right? Long history of that in the U.S. So this crash is, within that historical tradition. You know, in the Great Recession, in 1929-33, 17,000 U.S. small, medium banks disappeared. 17,000. Well, think about it. That's a lot of banks, right, during the Great Depression. And by the way, once they passed the Federal Reserve, the FDIC Act guaranteeing depositors in 34, 35, I think, no banks failed. They stopped the run of the banks. So they know if they throw money or promise to throw money at it, there's a good chance that they'll be able to stabilize it. And that's exactly what they're doing right now. $400 billion in the first week here. We'll see how much more it goes. Now, it's interesting how this thing in the U.S. is connected to what's going on in Europe. Europe banking system, I've been saying a long time, is in deep doo-doo. For a number of reasons. And, of course, the tip of that iceberg was this Swiss bank, Credit Suisse, that went under. Credit Suisse was in trouble well before this because, over-risky investments, you know, in Ponzi-style hedge funds like Archegos here that collapsed about a year ago. Credit Suisse almost imploded at that time. But they got investors to put their money in to sort of fill the black hole and save it temporarily. And they were just struggling, Credit Suisse, to come out from under that And then the banking crash hits in the U.S. And those same investors said, oh, we changed our mind. We're pulling the money out of Credit Suisse, or we're not going to put it in. Right, we're not going to put it in. And that was the beginning of the end of Credit Suisse. The regulators stepped in. The Swiss regulators stepped in. And over a weekend, forced Credit Suisse to merge with the other Swiss bank, UBS. Forced merger. In other words, we don't care what the terms are. You guys are merging. And the junk bond holders here at Credit Suisse, $17 billion, are going to lose their everything, every penny. But the shareholders of Credit Suisse will get $3.3 billion, which is kind of strange because usually they wipe out all the equity stockholders' value and they give something to the bondholders when a corporation, bank or non-bank, fails. That's the way it is. Bondholders get something and the shareholders get nothing. Well, they just, reverse that whole thing. The shareholders get $3.3 billion and the bondholders get an empty bag, right? Which is, had people scratching their head, what the hell's going on? Well, I think what's going on is, shareholders of Credit Suisse get $3.3 billion. UBS is buying Credit Suisse for, guess how much? $3.3 billion. Oh, I think the shareholders were bribed, and shareholders, big bank managers too, big shareholders, were bribed to go along with the merger with for the $3.3 billion. We'll find out. But it's kind of coincidental that they're bought for $3.3 billion and shareholders in Credit Suisse get $3.3 billion. That's too coincidental here. And, of course, UBS got a $100 billion loan from the Swiss government. Actually, $109 billion. Well, wait a minute. They're only spending $3.3 billion to buy Credit Suisse. Why are they getting $109 billion? Is there something going on at UBS that they're not telling us? Yeah. Well, is there also interesting that that whole forced merger bypassed all the shareholders in these banks? They didn't get the vote on any of this. The government said nope. We're doing it, and it's a done deal. Tough luck. So much for economic democracy argument that, owning companies and owning shares in companies means, it's democracy and you got a voice and blah, blah, right? Even the political parties in Switzerland had nothing to say about this. They're all bypassed. The bureaucracy, the state, the real capitalist people here got to make the decision, got to make it quick, and did make it quick, and worry about it later. So funny stuff going on over there with that merger, Credit Suisse. But the point is, the psychology, the global psychology of the instability in the banking system in the U.S. flooded into Europe. Now, Europe has its problem, similar to what was going on in the U.S., of the central bank, European Central Bank, and the Swiss National Bank, raising interest rates rapidly as well. Because if the U.S. raises rates, then other central banks have to raise their rates too. Because it's a global dollar system. And if the U.S. raises its interest rates, the dollar goes up in value, other currencies go down in value. So to protect the euro and the Swiss franc from collapsing, devaluing, what do? They raise interest rates in those countries as well. And, of course, raising interest rates caused bond prices, assets to collapse, and that was happening in Europe as well as here. So it's a similar dynamic going on, you see, in both sides of the Atlantic. And that was exacerbated by the fear factor of the banking system instability in the United States that caused, investors and would-be investors in Credit Suisse who had committed to help save Credit Suisse over the past year to say, no, we pull our commitment. And, of course, that created a big crash in the value of their stocks. Credit Suisse stock is at pennies, I think, now. Even UBS, I think, has dropped to like 10 cents on the dollar. I think it's like $10 a share, whatever. And once again, if you want to see the instability of a system, of a bank, just watch what's happening to the stock price and the withdrawals and the cost of credit default swaps insurance against a collapse. I mean, it costs like 36 or 37% Credit Suisse. Credit default swaps on Credit Suisse cost 36-37% for every dollar you had invested. You had to pay another 36 cents to insure against the collapse and loss of that dollar. At Credit Suisse, I mean, it just, you know, no one's going to do that. They're going to pull their money out. Okay, so you know, that's the connection here, the dynamic, because the capitalist financial system is a global. Think of it as a nerve system, you know, nervous system where all the tentacles, you got the nerve, you know, and you got tentacles going. Let's do a biological metaphor here. You got the nerve center, and you got all these tentacles going on from a nerve cell, right? And they're all connected to other tentacles and nerve cells. That's how the brain works, right? Well, global financial capitalism is like that. The banking system is like that, right? All these banks are connected to each other with a almost undefinable relationship of connectivity of debt, assets and debt, right? They all owe each other, and they're borrowing and selling and from each other all the time. And it's like electricity, you know, money is going between all of them electronically, like electricity along a periphery of a nerve cell, right? They're all connected. So when one goes, it causes a reverberation to others. In terms of their debt and their lending, and they got to cover, and they go to their borrowers and lenders to ask for cover, and you know the whole thing spreads. It's an intricate. It's like cancer, you know. It's like cancer permeates the human body, you know. It goes everywhere. Cells, you know, sort of go through the blood, you know, the blood vascular system, the bloodstream, right? These cancer cells go from one to the other, and they settle here in this organ and that organ and so forth, you know. That's the way the capitalist banking system works. So the contagion can go rapidly from one to the other, and especially rapidly now when you got technology, electronic and internet and all this stuff, right? It's instantaneous, wireless internet, all that. It's instantaneous almost, which makes it very difficult to regulate, very difficult for the regulators because they can't see what's happening. It's happening so fast, you see. Only when you have an eruption somewhere, you know, it breaks through the skin and they say, oh, gee. You know, oh, we got a cancerous lesion here. Oh, let's go and do something about the lesion, right? But underneath there, you know, the cancer is everywhere, not just where it pops out. When it pops out, it's too late, you see. But that's all the regulators can do. And, you know, the regulators, that's why they're terrified about cryptocurrencies, because they won't even be able to see what's happening with cryptos. And they don't like that idea, and you know they're going to squash cryptocurrencies here and create digital currencies by the governments. They're going to go after cryptos. Well, they are going after cryptos. Okay, they're individuals, right? There's this one big honcho here creating, you know, he's running around the world. They're chasing his ass all over the world now. And they grabbed him finally. I forget where the hell they grabbed him. Was it in Israel or someplace? I don't know. But they found him. You know, he created 30-year-old guy, you know, created this Ponzi scheme of cryptos, right? Anyway, I don't want to get into cryptos here. This show's not about cryptos, except that it's a bubble that bursts. It continually bursts, you know, it bursts, fills up again, bursts again, fills up again. But banks that have played the crypto game with regional banks and so forth. The big boys won't play the crypto game. They'll buy and sell it and take a fee, but they won't invest in it. You see, crypto's for the dummies, the small guys, the dummies who think that it's that the capitalists are going to let a digital alternative currency undermine their whole system. No way. Yeah. I mean, that's pretty naive to think that's going to happen. Okay, so, getting back to the Fed, to partially summarize, the Fed is responsible for these bubbles by throwing all this money into the economy, especially since 2007-08. That goes mostly into financial assets, creates bubbles. Right? The bubbles burst, and what does the Fed do? It throws more money at the bursted bubble to try to contain it. Think about that. What that means is that the solution to the crisis is the problem. Yeah, you may solve the crisis in the short run by throwing money, capital, bubbles, liquidity at it, but that only serves as the basis for the building of another bubble after. Yeah. I mean, think about it. That's pretty damn crazy, right? And it doesn't really stimulate the real economy very much. I mean, think about that. You know, the Fed threw $5 trillion in 2021 into the economy. And what did we get in terms of real economic expansion? Well, the first year we got like 5.4%, 2021. But last year, we got a 1% GDP growth rate from December to December. December 21 to December 22, the real economy grew 1% after a $5 trillion injection. Don't tell me that capitalist monetary policy is not broken, because it is. And it's also evident in the fact that when you raise rates 5%, you destabilize the whole financial system. That's another indication that the monetary system is broke as far as stabilizing the economies. It's broke. It's not broke as a conduit throwing trillions at the 1% and their investors. Oh, it's working fine. In that regard, it's working fine. It's a conduit to enrich the rich. Essentially, it's no longer a means for stimulating the real economy. $5 trillion, you get 1% growth rate. No longer means for that. And it's no longer a means for stopping inflation when it occurs. We still got 6%, after a 5% one-year run-up in interest rates. So in terms of its main mission, right, of stopping inflation, it's not working. As far as its mission of stimulating the real economy, it's not working. But in the meantime, lots of people are becoming billionaires. Now, that's a crisis, as far as I'm concerned. And, I talked about that in 2017, Central Bankers at the End of the Ropes book. I'm really talking. You can get it real cheap now on Amazon because it's so long ago. It's. I'm going to post the concluding chapter on my blog here. I'm writing a piece on the Fed, talking about what I'm talking to you about here today. I'm going to write a piece about the Fed and the banking crisis, and then I'm going to also then post on my blog, jackrasmussen.com, the concluding excerpts from the concluding chapter of that book, where I laid out all these predictions. I also, at the very end, put a postscript on that book, how to reform the Fed. You got to turn it into a public banking system. Yeah, that's the only way. Then you got to have regional public banking outlets, but, to do that, you're going to need legislation, and to solidify the legislation that I propose at the end of that book, I'm talking about a constitutional amendment. But you can't just pass legislation because the next regime will overturn the legislation. You need a constitutional amendment, so they can't do that. Right? But we really need to do something about the Fed and the Federal Reserve because it's broken. You know, it's not working the way it's intended to work, and all it's doing is serving as a conduit, free money to the rich. And that prevents it from doing what it's supposed to do, you see. So just check out my blog, jackladvis.com, in the coming week here. It won't be immediately tonight, but, you know, next week I will post the article and the reform proposals here for the Fed. Because, as I said, to kind of wrap up, you know, the Fed is the fundamental cause, and the Fed is the precipitating cause. It's got dirty, two hands of dirty here. And in between, of course, the regulators. The Fed is also one of the bank regulators, so the Fed is responsible in part for that, too. There's a whole, in the U.S., there's a whole network of bank regulators. They all share some responsibility, including state banks, the states as well as the federal, you know, the FDIC. The Fed has a regulatory arm, which is in deep doo-doo now, being focused on and criticized by the politicians. But the regulators, the lack of regulation and the bad practices of risk-taking you know, commercial banking institutions when you're in the middle of a bubble, because a lot of money can be made in a bubble, you know, and they really take high risk. They shouldn't take high risk at commercial banks, you see. That's the problem, right? Because you got retail depositors. Mom and pop put their money in the banks. Right? So mismanagement, deregulation, lack of regulation, that's an enabling cause. Precipitating cause is the Fed raising interest rates. Fundamental cause is the Fed pumping all this money over decades and years into the economy, into the banking system, which they then turn around and invest in financial assets and bubbles. See, that's the bottom line problem of what's going on here. But this is capitalism. This is 21st century capitalism. Financialized, globalized capitalism. And the financialization and the globalization has rendered its traditional fiscal monetary policy tools inefficient, ineffective. This is neoliberal capitalism. What are they going to do? They got to fix this. I mean, the fiscal policy is another one. You know, we're at $31.4 trillion national debt, not counting the Fed's $9 trillion, by the way, or another $4 trillion at state and local government debt. We're not counting that, right? Just $31.4 trillion. They can't keep going with that because interest rates this year on the debt is going to cost the government $600 billion. Okay, I guess that's it. We'll talk about this next week. I'm out of here.